Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority. In our latest roundtable discussion, we welcome back to the podcast Harry Sewell, who is a trainer and consultant in equality and social justice and author of Working with Ethnicity, Race and Culture in Mental Health. We also welcome back ex-white supremacist and now peace activist Arno Michaelis, author of My Life After Hate, and finally the chair of the Middle Way Society, the philosopher Robert M. Ellis, who has been a regular guest on the podcast and the author of many books, including the Middle Way Philosophy series. The topic today will be prejudice, what it is, how it affects us, and what we might do about it. Hello, everyone. Nice to have you all back on the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hello. Great to be back.
Hello.
Thanks, Barry. Great to be back.
Well, now, both Harry and Robert, you know each other, don't you? As you've both recently co-run a Middle Way Society retreat entitled Working with Prejudice. But I think it's the first time you've come into contact with Arno.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep, that's right, yeah.
Anyway, it's great to get the three of you together to talk about such an important subject. So, maybe I could ask you, Harry, to kick off with what prejudice is, as you understand it, and how inevitable it is.
Well, I guess there are many definitions of prejudice, but they all seem to center on the position where folk hold unwarranted views about another social group, probably based on some information that is false or exaggerated. Sometimes there might be truth to it, but often one of the processes with prejudice is that individuals get lost in a kind of sea of assumptions. Insofar as that individual then seems to be representative of the entire group to which they are identified with. And then all of the other kind of assumptions and associations of traits are then pinned onto that individual. So that really summarizes the kind of key features that appear in definitions of prejudice.
Okay. Any thoughts, the other two?
Yeah, I agree with everything Harry said. I think that's a great definition. When I think about prejudice, I think about the philosophical position of a priori. Uh-huh. So it's assumed knowledge. If someone says Arno is a bachelor, the a priori knowledge is that I'm single. That I'm tall or short, that's not a priori knowledge because we don't know of it ahead of time. But I think prejudice has to do with people assuming a priori things that aren't necessarily true. As Harry pointed out, sometimes there may be some basis in fact, but it's typically a position on a group or population of people and an assumption of assumed knowledge about that group from an individual.
So it's something that Harry said, it's something that's unwarranted, or could you say unreasonable?
I think for the most part, it's unreasonable. I think for anyone who seeks to live an enlightened life, we want to have as few expectations as possible. We don't want to go into situations thinking, I know what's going to happen. I know how this person's going to act. I know how they're going to behave. In my life, it's important to me to try to have things happen as organically as possible and to create as open a space to do that, and obviously prejudice would be very counter to creating that kind of experience. So for me personally, yeah, it's absolutely unreasonable.
Okay, and Robert?
Yeah, I agree very much with most of what Harry and Arno have said there. I mean, I suppose I'd put it very much in the terms that it's an absolute assumption about a person. It may be built on some things we can't help, some aspects of our humanity, if you like, but there's then an element we can help. There's an obsessive aspect to it because we tend to assume that we've got the whole story about a person and what they're like, even though, of course, we don't.
Yeah. And to what degree is prejudice inevitable? Are we all subject to it? Do we have to be on our guard all the time?
Well, as I was just saying, I think that there's a degree to which it's inevitable, and you know, that there may be some ways in which prejudice is just bias, which is to some extent just about being human, the human position. But there's also quite a lot that we can do something about. So it's a question of how we work with that. And that was the title of our retreat recently, was Working with Prejudice, how we respond to the feelings that come up, and whether we absolutize them or not, whether we treat them as the whole story or not.
I think there's definitely a relationship between prejudice and trauma. As a person is traumatized, the more trauma you've been through, the more susceptible you are to, you know, absolute reasoning and absolute thinking. You're going to want to actually seek that out. So I think that people who've been traumatized and haven't engaged in a healthy healing process are more likely to experience prejudice against other people. And I think also, so in that sense, I think it is inevitable. As we know, suffering is part of life. So since suffering is inevitable, I think prejudice is inevitable as well. It would just logically follow. At the same time, I don't think it's unavoidable. I think if we're, like anything else, if we're aware of our prejudices and we can be mindful of their appearances and how that might make us think or respond to people, then we can ask ourselves if this is really how we want to interact with the world and counter move accordingly.
Mm-hmm. I guess I would kind of say, with regard to whether it's inevitable, is there is a question of degree, and there's a question about the extent to which we see inevitability as something that we acquiesce in, or whether or not we say, actually, it's kind of inevitable that we'll have those tendencies, which then demands a response, which is, you know, we kind of think about ways to ameliorate the kind of prejudices that are likely to emerge, you know, because by definition of belonging to a family or to a social group or a community means that there are going to be things that become so well established as the norm that without thinking, we'll see something else as not being quite the norm, which then kind of underpins prejudice. So, you know, because we know that, there's a moral responsibility on all of our parts to then practice, I don't know, extending our social networks, kind of, you know, encountering difference and kind of noticing how we respond emotionally in other ways and try and kind of really, really deal with it. And, you know, as Robert said, with the retreat we had, it was very much about acknowledging those aspects and kind of working with the feelings and thoughts that come up. And once we start to practice that, then we get better at it. You know, the worst thing about kind of accepting inevitability would be to just, as I say, acquiesce in it and think, well, I give up trying.
Brilliant point.
Yeah. Well, can you maybe tell us a bit about your experience of prejudice in your own life, how you've acted out perhaps your own prejudices at times, and also being on the receiving end of the prejudices of others?
My relationship with prejudice has been fairly extensive throughout my life in the aspect of practicing it. Having been a member of white supremacist hate groups for 7 years, from the late 1980s to the early 1990s, prejudice was really my bread and butter. And I sought to provoke it and to cultivate it amongst white people and also amongst anybody else. I had much less of a problem with a black person who didn't like white people. In fact, I was very pleased when I would run across someone like that, because then I felt like we were on the same page, ironically. And while we wouldn't have been buddies, I felt that that was a way toward we shared a common goal, and that, like, working on from either end, we would attain the goal of racial separation. So that would be a for instance of how I viewed prejudice as a white power skinhead. As an individual, my entire life, I've kind of reveled in pissing people off, and I still do kind of. So I don't really mind if people get angry at me nowadays. But in the past, before I was a skinhead, I was a punk rocker, and as a punk rocker, I was trying to provoke people. I was trying to repulse people, and that's what led me to get involved in as a neo-Nazi skinhead, was the way that people were so repulsed by a swastika. Now, that I think is an example. Now, looking at it as with reason and with thought and compassion, it's perfectly reasonable that someone would be repulsed by a symbol that flew over the murder of 6 million people. But as an angry teenager, all I cared about was that people were repulsed and not why. So yeah. I've tried to evoke prejudice in other people, and as a white person, typically in society, where whiteness is kind of the norm and it's accepted social group, I had to like go the extra mile to provoke prejudice by being a punk rocker, by being a skinhead, by covering myself with tattoos and things like that.
And what about being on the receiving end? You've really turned your life around, Arno. Now, you know, you're well known for your book, My Life After Hate, and also you do a lot of peace work. But do at times people question your sincerity? Can you sense a prejudice there that, you know, a leopard can't change its spots?
Yeah, actually, but my first public speaking gig was at an event called the Black Men's Forum here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in the States. And go figure, the audience was predominantly black people. And for the most part, it was very well received. There was a 90-year-old black man who told me that I gave him hope. And that was really amazing for me. And I still always cherish that memory. But right after that, another younger black man said, "I don't know if I buy your turnaround." He said, I don't think a leopard can change his spots. And I said, well, if you watch like Discovery Channel, you'll see that a leopard's spots change throughout the cycle of its life. But in all seriousness, I invite people who doubt me to scrutinize me. So yeah. In that case, I welcome that kind of prejudice. And again, I don't mind when people feel that way. I've done horrible things. I've done things that deserve doubt. So to me, it's all the more an onus personally to prove, not so much prove people wrong, but to prove myself and to be sincere and genuine in everything that I do.
Okay. And what about you, Harry?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I left England when I was 5 years old and lived in Jamaica and came back to England when I was 15. And the striking thing for me was, being in Jamaica, you know, I kind of saw television and very, very seldom saw movies and kind of was aware of the bigger world. But kind of grew up in a society where, you know, the dentists, doctors, lawyers, politicians were black. So had no real sense of limited aspirations and, you know, that I should, you know, put parameters around my own goals and ambitions. And then when I came here at 15, I kind of had, you know, multiple examples of, you know, other people putting limitations or having lower expectations. You know, I remember my sisters when we were in church in London kind of talking about their hopes for the future, and you know, some folks said, "What are you planning?" And my sister said, "Oh, we're thinking about university when we finish school." And they raised eyebrows and said, "University? You sure you don't mean polytechnic?" Arno, polytechnic was kind of seen as a, you know, an other access to higher education, but was a substandard version
okay.
of it.
Okay, thank you.
And it just kind of seemed very strange, you know, in that church setting. And now that was kind of an early example of, you know, people kind of expecting lower aspirations from us. And it just kind of carried on like that. You know, I could just kind of spend days giving anecdotes of being followed around, you know, department stores or, you know, the secretaries to managers not recognizing that I might be a senior manager because, you know, even though I'm black and in a suit, they think that I must be somebody else, but I can't be that person with the job title they've been sent out to greet. And it kind of goes on. The stories just go on and on. So, you know, I kind of have experienced it quite a lot, you know, in the work environment, in public transport, just kind of whatever I've done. In terms of, you know, the kind of prejudices that I feel I've kind of held and also, you know, have kind of spilled over into discrimination haven't kind of been driven from malevolence or hatred. But as I kind of become more aware of how prejudice gets played out, I kind of think about assumptions that I might have made about, you know, women and the kind of roles that they might fulfill in the past, or I kind of think about, I worked with a guy who I later found out dated guys. But I remember kind of just saying to him, oh, you know, hi, you know, so, you know, how about you? Have you got a wife? And that was, or no, I said, are you married? I didn't say, have you got a wife? But at that stage, we didn't have a law that would have allowed for same-sex marriage in this country. And I kind of said, you know, are you married? And he just said no. And in the moment, I thought, there's probably a reason why the conversation just dropped off like that. But that kind of came from a kind of heteronormative view of the world that I had, which is, you know, what happens is people kind of grow up, they, you know, find a partner who's going to be of the opposite sex, and you know, if they're lucky, they're going to get married and have kids. So I guess for me, that had been the manifestation of my prejudices, kind of based on, you know, things that were just kind of normal to me, having grown up in the church and having grown up in a society that kind of very strongly established those norms, and I internalized them. And then, you know, as my worldview expanded, I kind of thought, well, you know, A, that isn't the way the world is. No matter how much some people would like it, it just isn't. And the second part of that is when we make assumptions about people, it kind of gives them a message that we see their way of life as being less valid. And there's a kind of phrase that academics use about non-validation, unconscious bias, you know, which really shuts down people's kind of opportunity to be sort of open and expansive about who they are. So that's kind of been my experience on both sides, really.
Okay. And you, Robert?
Well, I guess my examples would be pretty low key compared to these two guys, because I've had a, you know, relatively sheltered life compared to both of you, I guess. Yeah, relatively you know, stable, middle class background, you know, academic progress to Cambridge and things like this. So, but I guess there are obviously ways in which I've both experienced being on the receiving end of prejudice and to some extent giving it out. I think that the time I remember becoming aware of how some prejudice or degree of prejudice is innate, was one occasion when I remember having to go to the airport at 3 o'clock in the morning and arranging a taxi to pick us up, me and my wife, to go to this airport. And when the taxi arrived, the guy who knocked at the door was a black guy who I think was supposed to be about 6'6" or something like this. And I immediately recoiled, you know, so almost couldn't help myself that I was taken aback by this guy. Felt innately threatened as a sort of physical response. And then, of course, I did realize, hang on, I don't need to respond in this way. And I, you know, I didn't continue to do so. But it was an interesting moment for me, I think. But, you know, in terms of acting it out, I guess that's more been an occasions when I was withdrawing from something and overreacted. So sometimes I've been prejudiced against Christianity, for example. So I remember one occasion when I was at a conference for religious education teachers, because I was one of those at one point, and I refused to go and listen to Rowan Williams, who was this, you know, important Christian guy who became Archbishop of Canterbury, yeah, because I didn't want to listen to Christians. So there was definitely an acting out element there. In terms of being the receiving end of prejudice, to some slight degree, I know what racial prejudice feels like, despite obviously being brought up in England and being of entirely Anglo-Saxon stock, as far as I'm aware. But I'm slightly darker, perhaps, than average. For my skin tone is slightly darker than most Anglo-Saxons. And at school, I was actually called names. I was called Packy and things like this by a certain set of people. Perhaps because there weren't any genuine Pakistani people around in my school at that time. So people find a butt for prejudice sometimes, if they haven't, you know, something that's handy. Also, I've sometimes felt discriminated against as an introvert. So I think there's some degree of temperament-based discrimination. So job interviews are particularly a bane of my life, because I don't do particularly well in job interviews, and I often feel they're set up, they're stacked against my particular abilities and skills. So I can't show what I can do in that kind of situation. So I do feel there's a prejudice in society in general, in favour of certain temperaments and against others.
Can I ask a question, Robert? Hopefully this is okay. What did it feel like when you were called names based on an assumption about who you were? What did it feel like?
Well, obviously painful. And I guess in some ways I didn't take it very seriously because the people calling me the names obviously knew that I wasn't Pakistani. It was just a way of getting at me. The hatred behind it, the intention behind it was what was hurtful.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Well, another question. Would you say there's a hierarchy of prejudice based on belonging to a social group?
Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of interesting one. I mean, I'll talk about it in theory first and then kind of try and make it more personal. In the work I do a lot of work training people and kind of, you know, helping organizations think about prejudice and discrimination. And sometimes when I talk to, you know, groups who advocate for their own social group, they'll kind of think, well, when you're born into a group, then actually, you know, you've got no choice about that. But some people might choose to belong to a group, whether it's kind of, you know, someone who's got tattoos all over their arms, or some people kind of assume that, you know, people choose their sexuality and therefore, you know, if they experience discrimination based on that, then that's because they've chosen to do something. So I know some people kind of think, well, yeah, there is a hierarchy, you know, things that are biologically determined, you know, kind of separate out other groups. And, you know, in a way, I don't know if that kind of plays into some of the kind of aspirations of the LGBTQ community, who sometimes kind of, you know, emphasize the biological underpinnings to kind of say, well, this isn't a choice. This is, you know, how I was born. In a way to kind of shut down that conversation about, you know, it's a self-selection into a group. But leaving that aside, I kind of think it's a moot point about, you know, is there a hierarchy? Because, of course, what we're talking about is pain and an assumption of the value of one human life above another. And I kind of just don't exist in my world where I could kind of embrace such a belief. You know, I kind of think we just need to kind of think, well, all human beings have equal right to live and breathe. And, you know, that's why, you know, our approach to war or, you know, migration, you know, it kind of raises so many moral problems because, you know, we might say, for example, all lives matter, but then, you know, when ships sink in the sea, as people flee war-torn areas, our emotional response is less than it would be if it was someone kind of closer to us or someone in the social group to which we belong. So I don't think there is a hierarchy. There shouldn't be. But in real life, there sometimes seems to be a hierarchy played out.
Okay. What are your thoughts there, Robert?
Yeah, I think I agree with Harry very much there. That, I mean, I suppose it's also, I'm inclined not to think that there should be a hierarchy because I do tend to see prejudice as a type of bias, and that biases are pretty much on a level, you know, because they're a certain pattern of mistake that we tend to make. We tend to absolutize things. We tend to assume that things are a certain way before we consult our experience properly to try and shake them out. There seems to be basic similarity in the response from us, regardless of what the object of the prejudice is.
Okay.
I would definitely, we're on totally on the same page. I don't think there should be a hierarchy of prejudice, but there certainly is. A great example of it is on a political level. If you talk to someone on the far left, they're going to tell you how their prejudice against capitalist it's not a prejudice. It's just they're right. You know, they're just being correct, and you'll hear the exact same thing from the far right about socialists, and oh well, it's the self-selection aspect won't even come up. They'll be like, socialists are this and that, and they're bad, and they're destroying our society, and the left will say the same thing about capitalists, and each side can cite examples all day long. They can speak at length about how communism slash socialism slash capitalism is the worst thing to ever happen to the human race, or the best thing alternatively. But they're unaware that their political attachments are what's establishing this hierarchy of prejudice. So they're not aware that their prejudices are prejudice, and they only see prejudices that don't jibe with their political beliefs as prejudices. So I think in that sense, there's always going to be those hierarchies. But I, in a personal sense, again, and I think like in an enlightened society sense, it's important to understand that prejudice of any sort is at least as damaging to the person wielding the prejudice as it is to the person who on the receiving end of the prejudice, in the sense that the person practicing prejudice is narrowing the possibilities in their own life. Sure. And seeing, as someone who is like willfully engaged in prejudice in the form of like vehement, violent racism for 7 years today, one of the reasons why I'm as open as I could possibly be, and like Harry said, I make a point of practicing that so I get good at it and I'm familiar with it, is because I understand how much my prejudices damaged me and limited my choices, limited my potential, my possibilities back in my youth.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I know. Well, let's. You've touched on this already, but maybe we could just unpack a bit more what we can do about prejudice then. Maybe you could start with this one, Robert.
Okay, I mean, I guess I see prejudice very much in the wider context of getting stuck, of getting in fixed assumptions, of getting in biased states. So for me, I guess the solutions tend to be very general. I'm sure Harry will probably say more about more specific things we can do, but I just tend to talk in terms of integrative practice in general. So I think... meditation, for example, is likely to be, or working with the body, some kind of body discipline, for example, is very likely to be helpful, simply in making our states of mind more open so that we are able to consider other possibilities. And then any kind of practice which allows us to encounter different types of people as meaningful and to understand them better. So maybe travel, learning languages, reading widely, and so on, you know, is probably going to help. And then also a critical thinking side of things. So being able to interrogate our beliefs intellectually and consider alternatives again, perhaps in a more intellectual way. So I think we need to work at all those levels. There's a level of sort of immediate physical responses, level of what we find meaningful, and level of what we believe, and all of those are ways in which we can work with biases in general, prejudice included.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's superb because, you know, it touches on the mind, the body, the spirit. Absolutely, you know, endorse that. I think I kind of want to take us back to the discussion we had on a previous question, which could. You know, I can imagine some people listening thinking, well, you know, if we're saying there's not a hierarchy and, you know, that we shouldn't pit one set of views against another, is that a kind of a relativist, you know, kind of approach to the world where we say, well, yeah, kind of anything you believe is okay. And you're like, how do we expect people to hold views? Because we will, but to hold those views without prejudice. And I think, you know, I'd just like to kind of declare myself on it to say, you know, I kind of think it's reasonable that people are going to hold different views. The prejudice comes from the response we have to others who have a disagreement with us. And it is hard, you know, if you're kind of going to go back to what Arno was saying about kind of, you know, the left and the right politically. You know, if you really believe that the other side is damaging or is breeding hatred or is, you know, kind of accumulating wealth for one group at the expense of another, it's hard not to feel angry because kind of, you know, anger is what then kind of motivates and empowers people to take action. So, yeah, and kind of, you know, what we can do about it I guess it's first to acknowledge that, well, yeah, there are going to be a diversity of views and positions and worldviews kind of based on our experiences, and that it kind of is a requirement of us to step outside of what has now become known as the echo chamber. You know, if we keep surrounding ourselves by, you know, kind of voices that, you know, echo and reflect back to us our own thinking, then we become stunted. And, you know, as Robert was saying, by, you know, reading widely and, you know, having the discipline to promote our critical thinking about things that might be outside our normal frame of reference. So if you're a socialist, to kind of understand, well, you know, what is it that, you know, economists, you know, from a capitalist viewpoint actually really bang on about, and kind of explore it, because it may be that there are some kind of truths. And the one thing, well, there are two things that it does, kind of stepping outside our normal frame. One is it hopefully creates humility. The more we realize that some of the views that we've held have been kind of fixed and perhaps unwarranted, it kind of helps us to kind of become more humble, because we, you know, realize where we're coming from. But the other is it kind of creates empathy with others. You know, so we might say, well, I still kind of disagree, but I can kind of see where it's coming from. And then it opens up the possibility of a relationship that's based on something mutual, as opposed to me kind of locking you in a small room, getting out all my academic texts and trying to kind of bash you into believing my viewpoint. You know, which is what, you know, it's a caricature of something that we kind of often do in social situations. And, you know, the kind of empathy and humility, I think, along with what Robert was saying about the body, the mind and the spirit, and our intellect, you know, those things kind of help us, I think, shift prejudice.
Okay. And Arno, what are your thoughts?
Those are all fantastic points, guys. I totally agree. I would want to reiterate what Robert pointed out about meditation. Going back to trauma, the relationship between trauma and prejudice, I think it's essential that a sense of inner peace is cultivated and practiced, and like that's the foundation that we work from. If you don't have that inner peace, you're going to have a really hard time having any kind of outer peace with any other people or groups of people or anything like that. So that's a very important place to start. Meditation is a perfect vehicle for that. I think from that foundation, we can work to other foundations. And I think that a place where human beings can kind of come together and find a common place to work from, whether they're a fan of capitalism or socialism, is that we're all, or any other, you know, polar points, is to see what we all share as human beings, to see our common humanity. I really believe that all human beings have far more in common than we have different. And once you can not only understand, but appreciate and cultivate those commonalities, now you can see these differences as assets to cherish rather than liabilities to be afraid of. And I found that a really great way to engage with these common human aspects of our experience is to work with things like forgiveness, kindness, gratitude, compassion. I think those really noble aspects of the human experience transcend things like politics, and they can create a space where we can have political discussions, which, as Harry pointed out, are perfectly valid. Politics are kind of how we interpret how the world works and how we want to solve problems. So it's not something we just want to sweep under the rug and pretend doesn't exist. But if we don't create a healthy spot to have a constructive conversation about politics, it can very easily become a rock and mud slinging exercise, and that doesn't help anybody.
And what progress do you think we are making in this regard? Do you think, you know, if you look back to 50 years ago, 100 years ago, or 500 years ago, do we have better structures in place to at least to mitigate prejudice, or are we in ourselves less prejudiced than, say, 100 years ago?
I think it's really fascinating to think about how much the internet and social media has changed the human experience just in the past 30, 40 years. I think all of us are part of this rare generation where we I'm just guessing, like looking at you guys on Skype here, I think all of us maybe as children we didn't have the internet in our lives, and now we're communicating over it. So I think it's a really amazing tool to break down prejudice, and at the same time it can also be a tool to cultivate it. Yeah. So like, you know, fire can heat your house or it can burn it down. And we need to be very mindful of the power of technology, social media especially. It's very easy to silo ourselves. On Facebook, I'm guilty myself of unfollowing people who are just constantly blasting out stuff that I find really distasteful, because I don't have the time or energy to engage all 3,000 something of my Facebook friends and ask them why they're acting the way they do. So, but I understand that when I do unfollow someone, I'm creating a silo, and I'm creating that echo chamber that Harry's talking about, where all of a sudden now I'm choired and we're preaching to each other, and we're not getting outside of our comfort zones to experience different points of view and different political and social opinions. So it's something that really requires a constant awareness and mindfulness to navigate in as healthy a way as possible. And to answer the question, I'm an optimist. I think despite the huge challenges we face today as a species, as a human race, I think we're headed in a good direction, and that ultimately all this technology and interconnectivity can work in our favor and put us in a position to meet the challenges that we face together.
Okay, great. And Robert?
Yeah, if you're talking about us as Western society, at least, then there are all sorts of reasons why prejudice has generally, on average, decreased. I mean, there's general rise in tolerance, liberal democracy. If you think of all the minority groups that used to be persecuted and whose rights didn't used to be recognized, they've gradually changed. Whether you talk about the status of women, the status of people of different races, status of LGBT people, and so on. Yeah? But then there's also the levels of education, which have generally increased in the Western world. And there's the interconnection that Arno talked about and globalization. So all of those provide reasons why we're making progress. But of course, any sort of sign of progress in general may well be accompanied by steps backward as well. And I wonder if we're seeing one of those at the moment, particularly in terms of Brexit and Trump and the kinds of, the relationship those seem to have with the echo chamber effect that Arno was talking about as indications of new prejudices coming to the fore. I hope those are temporary phenomena, but obviously we'll have to see. There's no telling.
Okay, and Harry?
Yeah, I kind of feel we are making, it's almost as though there are two tracks running alongside each other. You know, one is about progress. You kind of think about the law. When Robert was talking about his experiences, being called Paki as a child, the law in England, the Equality Act, actually covers, discrimination against groups, even when you don't bear the characteristic, but people assume you do. And that kind of almost underpinned my question about, well, what did it feel like? Because it can still be painful, even if you're not that thing that people assume that you are. And the law covers situations like that. So, you know, we're seeing a lot of laws, putting some kind of rings around people's potential behaviors. And that's kind of good and empowering for others, because, of course, it has a prospective protective element, does the law, because people know if they overstep the mark, they can be taken to court and they can be prosecuted. So it has that kind of ameliorating effect. It doesn't only have a retrospective effect. So that's good. And the kind of second point of the progress is that, with so many examples of people looking back and saying, well, 50 years ago, we would have thought this, and, we now realize how wrong it is. We're building up more and more of an evidence base that actually, maybe the things that we have prejudices about now, in 20 years time or 50 years time, we might look back and cringe because we kind of think, well, yeah, this seems to be the nature of our progress as humans. The kind of reverse track, however, is that with globalization in the sense of, you know, travel and kind of communities who are unfamiliar with each other coming into contact with each other, what we're finding is that sometimes it entrenches and sometimes reawakens previous prejudices, because people can articulate an openness as long as they don't need to live with the consequences of needing to shift their views and kind of working with people or living with people who are different. And the more we kind of bump into each other and kind of find that, well, yeah, you know, kind of getting on with the right wing folk, you know, I kind of aspire to do that. But actually, you know, it's like Arno said, you know, having kind of, you know, the 15th comment on your Facebook and you kind of think, no, I can't do this, it's poisoning me, I need to kind of retract. Then I think we kind of experience that socially, in terms of real contact with people. And that kind of feels like we're kind of going into reverse. And that's the kind of, you know, the Trumpism or the Brexit stuff that Robert was talking about, that, you know, as people kind of think, well, you know, some people call it an experiment. The experiment isn't working. You know, multiculturalism isn't working. And there's a whole, you know, body of literature now that would argue that point. And that for me is the challenge. And I guess the assumption, and Robert Putman, you know, in Bowling Alone kind of, you know, talks about the assumption is that social contact is going to work to change people, and social contact theory has become discredited as an assumed way to solve some of these kind of problems of prejudice. And what we need to do is to add in something that actively kind of challenges and kind of helps people to work together. So yeah, we're making progress, but the next stage is for us to think about, well, what does it take to actively engender some kind of harmony and, you know, empathy and understanding, as opposed to just pushing people together and hoping for the best.
That's where education could be far more effective than it is, I think, generally, in terms of doing the sort of things I mentioned earlier, that so emotional education, critical thinking education, particularly. So if all children knew how to meditate, you know, how much difference would this make?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Well, I'm coming to my last question, the question I ask in all the podcasts. How does all this, what we've been talking about today, relate to the middle way? Arno, would you like to kick off with that?
Yeah, absolutely. When I think middle way, I think of openness, and I think of possibility, and I think of potential. And I think our entire conversation, a theme that has run through it is how prejudice destroys possibility and prejudice destroys potential. So getting across the value of the middle way is really crucial here. In order to get people engaged in something, everything, you know, I think we all have an innate sense of self-preservation and self-interest, although that self-interest can very often be misinterpreted. But when you truly understand interdependence, or understand its certainty, then you can understand that maybe not digging in to one side or the other is going to be beneficial to you. It's going to help you be a better person, a better father, son, brother, mother, sister, daughter. It's going to help you be a better friend. It's going to help you be more effective at whatever your career choice is. It all comes back to impermanence. Understanding that this universe is in constant flux from a micro to a macro level. There's absolutely nothing that is stationary, and really the only constant that we can truly depend on is change. So the more comfortable we become with change, I think the less tendencies we have to practice prejudice and to act out on it, and the more open we become to other ideas, to different sorts of people that we're not familiar with. And we can see those kind of interactions as assets rather than liabilities.
Okay, great. And Harry?
Well, yeah, I guess for me, it's like trying to remove the full stops from kind of really, you know, arguments and conversations about things and kind of, you know, the position that we're trained, you know, either through, you know, education or through the norms in society, the position that we're kind of trained to hold is that we kind of state a position and put a full stop there. And in a way, it shuts down other possibilities. And I kind of think, you know, that in a way is what really enables prejudice to be fostered, is by saying, okay, you know, this is how I see it. Okay. And, you know, you can kind of see in arguments, domestic or otherwise, you know, when people, that's the point at which people leave the room and say, anyway, you know, this is just the way it's got to be. And they walk out. And for me, the kind of middle way society and the kind of middle way approach is about saying, well, you know, let's kind of not put the full stop there, and let's kind of, you know, maybe put a semicolon and kind of, you know, carry on and think, oh, you know, let's critique it. Is that really the end of that argument? And explore those possibilities and to kind of be open to them, and to not just kind of do that intellectually, but, you know, to kind of go back to what Robert and Arnaud also said about kind of meditation, to recognize what we're talking about is a practice. And, you know, as an athlete myself, I know, you know, I don't do my pre-season training, get to the beginning of May and think, brilliant, I've now done my prep for the season, and then now I'll just race for the rest of the season, because I'll find that by the third race, you know, everything's just starting to tail off. And, you know, that kind of, you're required to just kind of keep on, even if you're at peak performance, and the work doesn't get any easier. You still go out there and grind, and it hurts. Because you have to keep working to maintain. And I kind of think, you know, the middle way approach is kind of partly that on a spiritual level, to say, you know, let's keep kind of working to kind of explore, you know, what's beyond that full stop that makes us feel so comfortable. And, you know, I kind of, you know, I was looking, you know, at the three, because of course, you know, we're doing this by Skype, and I'm seeing, you know, kind of three male faces and kind of seeing my face in the bottom corner, and I think, wow, I wonder if we had a woman as kind of part of this, you know, how that might have changed it. And just kind of being, and that's what I mean, kind of thinking, okay, you know, we've got our frame of reference as a group of four men or three participating here, and like, you know, thinking, well, what's beyond that, you know, constantly pushing boundaries like that.
Exactly, yeah. Okay, and Robert?
Yeah, I love that way of putting it, Harry, as questioning the full stops, yeah. I mean, the middle way for me is, it's finding an openness, yeah, between positive and negative absolutes. So, and obviously, prejudices are absolutes. They're as we've been saying. So they tend to assume that there's a full stop. That there's an assumption of having the final story, or even as Arnaud put it earlier, it's a priori. It's assumed to be the basis on which things run. And obviously you can do this. I mean, we haven't really talked about positive prejudice, but you know, you can have an idealization of somebody as well as a negative prejudice against them. So the other side can take that form, or it could also take the form of an overreaction against prejudice. So, I mean, that's a whole other discussion, I suppose, as to what different forms that could take, and subtle or less subtle. There are all sorts of absolute positions that one can get into, but the middle way is about practicing looking at what we experience in between, recognizing particularly that we have bodies, and therefore we can't actually attain the certainties of views about others that prejudice would assume. So for me, obviously, the middle way, one of the clear implications of the middle ways is the avoidance of prejudice and working with the prejudices we experience perhaps innately.
Okay, that's fantastic, guys. Thank you very much for talking on this subject today. It's been really interesting. Thank you.
Thank you, Barry.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much, all you guys. It's an honor to meet you and to talk again, Barry, Harry, and Robert. It's been a lot of fun, and I really appreciate everything you guys had to say. I mean, it's something I'll be taking with me and will be involved in my thought going forward. So thank you very much for that.
You can find out more about Middleway philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.